Well, ladies and gentlemen, the subject of the EU and terrorism, a common threat and a common response, has been a subject I've been working on for some time, also during the last 3 years when I directed the Sekarint project at the University of Strasbourg, funded by the EU, on governance of the European Union in the justice and home affairs domain. What I'm trying to do this evening is to, first of all, answer the two questions which actually are in the title. The question, to what extent terrorism is seen as a common threat by the European Union, and then also answer the second question, to what extent this common threat has been met by a common response. At the end, I would also like to draw some conclusions on the way ahead for EU action in this context. I would like to start with the question whether the European Union has actually a role as a provider of security at all. What are the problems of conceptualizing the European Union as a provider of security? Now, if we are talking about security, we are dealing with one of the most essential state functions which there can be. If you look at the great classics of political thinking going back to antiquity, but also the great theorists of the age of the Enlightenment, John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, Montesquieu, and Rousseau, they all emphasize that the primary function of the state is to provide security. In the sense of security certainly being not everything, but without security, all other goods being potentially endangered. And much of the establishment of the modern nation state has actually been based on the security providing function, in the sense that the build-up of central state administrations, the build-up of centrally controlled armed forces, all has been justified by the security providing function. So if now, today, at this stage of the European integration process, the European Union starts to move in the direction of security provision, this is a very relevant, a very important process, but remains a very difficult process. We have here an area which is heavily protected still by state sovereignty, by the concept of national sovereignty in the internal security domain, by the principle of territoriality of law enforcement, and also by still very strongly formulated national policy interests, which can considerably vary between the member states of the European Union. Nevertheless, the member states of the European Union, and especially since the 1990s, have moved in the direction of gradually putting into place two frameworks for addressing security risks. The first of those is the Common Foreign and Security Policy, the CFSP, which formally introduced in 1993, has led to an increasing coordination, cooperation in the foreign and security policy sphere, dealing primarily with the external aspects of security provision. A bit later, formally, only since 1999, the European Union has introduced the area of freedom, security, and justice as a fundamental treaty objective. And in this context, for the first time in the history of the integration process, there's an explicit competence to act on internal security matters. Now, especially the latter aspect, this last mentioned aspect, is really an innovation, because if you look at the texts and the memoirs, the memoranda written by the founding fathers of the integration process in the 1950s, you had there certain blueprints for cooperation in the foreign and security policy domain. But the internal security domain, police cooperation, judicial cooperation in criminal matters, was really considered to be a taboo area because it was so much related to national competences, to national traditions. So the founding fathers didn't even, in a forward-looking perspective, risk to touch upon this domain. So we therefore now have policy frameworks at the EU level to address both internal and external security aspects. But, and this is important to mention right at the outset, in each case, the EU has only a role as an additional subsidiary framework for providing security. It is not replacing the member states in their original security providing function. There are ample provisions made in the treaty which protects the continuing national functions as, of the member states as security provider. So the European Union comes in as a supplementary level of action. Terrorism is an interesting subject to actually test what the European Union can deliver in terms of security, because it is a subject which, although it has a strong internal security dimension, also has certain aspects which deal with the external relations part. So to some extent, it's a cross-cutting security challenge. It is also an old challenge for the European countries. When there were the September 11 terrorist attacks, I read in one US, pretty well-known US paper, actually, that finally even the Europeans would need to wake up to the challenge of terrorism. Well, obviously, we know that, unfortunately, the Europeans had much earlier and more comprehensive experiences with the threat of terrorism, especially since the 1970s, when in various European countries, including the United Kingdom, the terrorist challenge really developed into a major challenge, even attaining constitutional dimensions in several European countries. So since the 1970s, the European countries are coping with this challenge, trying to cope with this challenge, and since the 1970s, there have been certain forms of intergovernmental cooperation in this sphere. So there is a certain tradition of cooperation already, although it was a purely intergovernmental one in the past outside of the treaty framework. There's also the element that there is, by and large, a very strong tradition in Europe to regard the terrorist challenge as primarily being a law enforcement challenge, and to keep it within the domain of a law enforcement challenge. I was at a meeting which is called the Meeting of the Transatlantic Editors of Journals Dealing with Transatlantic Issues in Philadelphia in May of last year. And there I got quite a few questions from US editors how the Europeans could actually still regard terrorism as a law enforcement challenge only, because it was pretty clear that all instruments of the state had to be mobilized, including military instruments. So you had really in the background very much this notion of a war on terror, which actually justifies full deployment of state action means in alternative to the main law enforcement approach of the European countries. But one can actually say that this is an element of consensus amongst the member states, that the core of the response must be a law enforcement response to this challenge in order to uphold the liberal constitutional traditions of the member states and to prevent any militarization of the response, which could also have negative spillover effects at the domestic level. So from the perspective of the tradition of the European Union, the member states, terrorism is primarily a law enforcement challenge, and hence you have very strong emphasis on internal security responses, on responses actually in the context of this area of freedom, security, and justice established in 1999. This doesn't exclude the use of other instruments of the European Union. Doesn't exclude use of common foreign and security policy instruments when it comes to cooperation with third countries. But it means that the primary emphasis is actually on this area of freedom, security, and justice as a framework. And there we have actually pretty strongly worded security mandate, which is legally formulated since 1999 in the treaties, to provide European citizens with a high level of security laid down in Article 61 ETC and 29 of the Treaty on European Union. By the way, in the two treaty articles, you have in one provision reference to a high level of safety and in the other provision, high level of security. I was told by the legal service that it means exactly the same, but what didn't have enough time in the IGC to actually standardize all the treaty provisions. So one can see that they are sometimes in great haste that the constitutional law for the European Union is drawn up. A common threat, the first question then. Here one can say that what is quite interesting to see is that the European Union's threat definition of terrorism has actually evolved. We have had a first phase, which was the old, so to say, intergovernmental phase of cooperation, where we had what I would describe as a low-density common definition, where you basically had very broad principles agreed upon in the declarations of the Council that terrorism threatens the constitutional orders of the member states, the fabric of society, that it also can have major economic consequences. But these declarations nearly copied, I would say, 90% the international text in the fields, the UN declarations and other major international. There was not so much of a specificity of the EU approach, and most of the content remained relatively vague. Then, after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, you really had a major effort made on the EU side to reconceptualize the terrorist threat, to provide a deeper analysis, to arrive at a better common platform of the understanding of this threat. And I describe this as a move to a higher density common definition. You had initially, after the September 11 attacks, in the first few weeks after the attacks, certain mirroring on the European side of the US approach, the US view of the threat as a global external Islamist threat. So there was a lot of emphasis put in the Council text on a completely new threat posed by global Islamist networks, which could actually operate anywhere with international financial support. And what is quite interesting is that even the language was a bit close to the language used on the US side, this being regarded as primarily an external threat, so something coming from outside. But then, increasingly, from the end of 2001 through 2002, you had a shift in the sense, because it became increasingly evident that the threat was also partially homegrown, in the sense that you had terrorist cells inside of the European Union having actually played a role in the preparation of the US attacks, and that actually the threat was at least coming as much from the inside and from the outside as regards this new, in quotation marks, new Islamist threat. So one can say that there was a growing internalization of this initial view that this was primarily an external, a global threat. And secondly, you also had an increasing differentiation. The initial focus after September 11 was very much on the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks, the Al-Qaeda network. But then, gradually, it came again to the forefront that there are a lot of other terrorist problems inside of the EU, so that the threat posed by Islamist extremism is only part of the threat, the overall threat picture. What is quite important to be always in mind that really one of the most significant developments since 2001 is that even the threat posed by the Islamist networks is to a large extent a homegrown, home-fed threat. And what is quite a nice way to show this is from the latest Europol terrorism situation report, where it actually shows a number of arrested terrorist suspects in 2007. I rang Europol last week to find out whether they have the new data, but not all the member states have already provided the data for last year. So I have to use the 2007 data. I don't think that the data for last year will be much different. So you can see 69% of those arrested for presumed terrorist attacks were EU nationals. So you can see to what extent actually we have here a homegrown dimension to this. What are the current key elements then of the EU's threat definition? The first element is, and this is in the tradition also of previous text, that actually the terrorist threat is a threat to the democratic, liberal, constitutional orders, as well as the political, social, and economic stability of the member states. You have a greater emphasis these days on also the economic consequences of terrorist attacks than this was the case in the 1990s. I think it's very much also under the influence of actually the economic implications which the 9/11 terrorist attacks had. So a greater awareness of also the deep economic impact, but otherwise in line with previous texts. Then what you find in the current document is a strong emphasis on this threat having a significant cross-border dimension. Because of the cross-border links of the terrorist networks, because of terrorist financing, which really has an international dimension, and the trafficking of arms and explosives involved. The emphasis on the cross-border dimension has, of course, to do with the overall EU constitutional framework, because the EU constitutional system is based on the principle of subsidiarity. And in the context of security threats, subsidiarity applies. So basically, if the EU wants to develop measures, in each case, a justification has to be provided that actually added value can be provided by the European Union. And because the terrorist threat is so strongly of a cross-border dimension, the case can be made more strongly that under the principle of subsidiarity, EU action can obviously provide an additional value. Relatively new in the texts adopted by the Council since 2004 is the specific emphasis of the vulnerability, of the specific vulnerability of the European Union because of its openness. Now, this is something which was not so much emphasized in the 1990s. Here, we have a reference to the fact that you have in the European Union, at least among the Schengen countries, a system without internal border controls, which means that persons, and unfortunately also terrorists, can move much more freely across internal borders than in a classic system of cooperating nation states. So this openness of this European space is regarded as something which can potentially be abused by terrorists, and therefore there's a specific vulnerability of the EU as such. Then it is recognized that this is an internal threat. Now the main emphasis is actually on the internal threat situation, but with a major external dimension as well. So basically you need both internal measures and external measures to respond to it. And then finally, since the counterterrorism strategy of 2005, the Islamist threat is identified as one of the major threats, but not the only one. So the next in the list is actually separatist terrorism and still significant levels of left-wing and right-wing terrorism as well. So basically quite a differentiated threat perception. If you compare this with US documents, you have obviously a much stronger emphasis in the US on the threat posed by Islamist terrorism. So the EU view of the terrorist challenge is much more differentiated. Now, you have this common definition, but this common definition is based on still major persisting differences in national threat situations. And here we have differences in terms of the origin of the threat. In some member states, the threat posed by Islamist extremism is much bigger, considered to be much bigger than in other member states. You have member states where the separatist threat is considered to be the primary threat. So really have differences in terms of the origin of the threat. You also have differences in the nature of the threat, which is linked to actually the origin. You have separatist terrorist organizations which still primarily target in their attacks individual persons which are representative of government institutions rather than engaging in large-scale terrorist attacks, just to give an example. So basically, the types and size of the likely attacks can vary considerably from one member state to the other. And all this together means that you have differences also in the overall extent of the threat which the member states feel themselves under. To exemplify this a bit, here is also from the Europol TISAT report a statistic of the main of the member states which have actually reported terrorist attacks as failed, foiled, or successfully executed. And you can see here that you really have a widely differing spectrum. You have, first of all, what might be perhaps surprising to you, really is a separatist terrorism in terms of the individual incidents being by far the largest category. One has to say many of these terrorist incidents are really of small scale. For instance, in France, any arson attack, for instance, in Corsica, is counted as a terrorist incident. In terms of the classification under EU legislation, this is correct. But one should see that obviously the scale of the attack and the background can vary widely. Also, quite interesting is that only those countries of the 27 member states who are listed there have reported terrorist attacks. This means all the others haven't had any terrorist incident. So you can really see it's a widely diverging picture in terms of terrorist incidents, most of the member states not having had any terrorist incident, and some actually being touched, so to say, very lightly by the phenomenon, such as Austria, with just one left-wing incident. And further indication is the number of verdicts for terrorism charges, which have been pronounced during 2007. You can here see again that you have only part of the member states actually exposed under this statistical analysis, and you find a large you find that the first list and the second list largely overlaps with again the United Kingdom, Spain, France, and Germany, and Italy being amongst the forefront. So again, you have a concentration of the terrorist threat on certain member states only, and correspondingly. Also here an indication among the verdicts which have been pronounced. You can also see here that in the case of the United Kingdom, you have a relatively high number of verdicts regarding Islamist terrorists during 2007. These are the raw data of terrorists, of terrorist incidents and verdicts pronounced on terrorist charges. What is also of importance politically is the threat perception of citizens in the European Union. And here, this I choose data from December 2007 because this is where the other data were related to. And here you can, the question was asked, it's a Eurobarometer set of data, what do you regard, this was what the citizens were asked, as the two most important challenges your country is facing? And here it's actually quite striking to see the differences. You have in the case of Spain, 37% of the respondents, which actually said this is one of the two major issues facing the country. For the obvious reasons, ETA, we know this. You have, in the case of the United Kingdom, also a relatively high response rate of 17.5%, and in the case of Denmark, of 17%. Now, you have seen that Denmark only had one terrorist incident during 2007, so you may ask why are the Danish citizens so concerned? Well, you probably all remember the caricatures of Muhammad and the threats which actually were made in this context. So Danish citizens really got very worried about likely terrorist attacks. Now, but otherwise, you can see that really you have partially very low levels of threat perception of citizens. The bottom was the price of the bottom rate was achieved by Latvia with 0.1 responders. So you can say there's almost no terrorist threat perception of citizens in Latvia from this perspective. Now, why is this of relevance? Because this all together amounts to really different national threat perceptions. You have different national threat assessments in the first place, so the terrorist threat is not valued at the same height, the same extent in the member states. This results in different national response strategies to the terrorist threat, and again, in different degrees of prioritization. I have conducted interviews in some of the new member states, and for instance in Warsaw I was told, oh yes, of course the fight against terrorism is very important for us and we agree with the EU objectives, but you know we have a lot of other problems. We have problems with organized crime and this also demands resources. So basically if member states' capitals do not have the same sense of priority of the fight against terrorism, you have necessarily different resource allocations and different national commitment also to the implementation of certain measures. So this is really a problem for the European Union because you may have, as the European Union has, a very nice, sophisticated, differentiated common threat definition. But if the perception behind it is not the same, then you have a lower political will actually backing this up. So this would be my answer to the first question. Yes, we have a common threat in the sense of having a common threat definition, which has been agreed after a lengthy process. It's a very comprehensive one, but it rests on rather weak foundations because strongly diverging national threat perceptions which forms the foundation. Common response. Why do the member states actually engage in a common response in the first place? Well, some of the elements here are pretty obvious. The first is through common action, you can increase the effectiveness and efficiency in cross-border law enforcement action and prosecution. You can, through cooperation, ensure that there are no safe havens for terrorists, that they can be actually prosecuted effectively across borders through cooperation between the prosecution authorities. You can actually make the specialist branches of the member state interact. You can share intelligence to actually identify and dismantle the networks. There are all sorts of operational reasons aimed at increasing efficiency. And because it's essentially a phenomenon which nearly always has some cross-border dimension, really the cooperation can provide added value. Secondly, you have collective action possibilities in the international context. The EU as a group of 27 countries can simply make its weight felt more effectively in international relations when it comes to adopting common positions in the United Nations, to actually putting some pressures on third countries which might actually be linked partially to terrorist financing, etc. So there is also the external, the foreign policy context of acting as a group in this matter. And thirdly, and this should not be forgotten, there is also the potential to contribute to the political credibility of the EU's area of freedom, security, and justice. The heads of state and government in the European Council meetings have now repeatedly argued that this is a domain where actually the European Union can provide added value, where citizens can be shown that the European Union can do something on this fundamental public good, which is security. Is there a justification for this view that actually citizens might react positively to EU actions in this context? Well, if one actually looks at Eurobarometer opinion polls, actually the latest Eurobarometer edition, it's quite interesting. The question here has been asked, for each of the following areas, do you think that this decision should be made at the national government level or jointly at the European Union level? And interestingly enough, you have a very high response rate which for terrorism. Actually, it's at the top of the whole list. So you have 79% of the respondents actually felt that the fight against terrorism should be conducted jointly at the EU level. Followed, just to indicate the priorities perhaps a bit, by a protection of the environment and scientific and technological research. Well, I think the fieldwork was done over the summer of last year. Now, if this would be asked, I think probably we would have potentially the financial crisis changing some of the order. But interesting is also the area where citizens seem to trust the EU least is pensions, which is really at the bottom end, and taxation. So there's also a message there, I think, from the European integration perspective. But a very highly positive response of citizens for action in counterterrorism at the EU level. Now, just to complete this picture, this doesn't mean that it's uniformly in all of the member states the same. The darker the color here on this map, the more support there is for collective EU action at the European Union level. And you see that the United Kingdom is slightly paler than the average. Now, I think there are some good explanations here. If you look at opinion polls in the United Kingdom, British citizens have a relatively high trust in their own authorities actually being capable to respond effectively to the terrorist threat. So I think what plays in here is really, let's say, a trust in the experience of British authorities to respond to this threat, and that the European Union does not potentially add substantially to this. Whether this is correct or not, I leave it aside, but I just say this relatively, what means relatively, the UK is at the bottom, the 65% support rate for EU action in counterterrorism has a lot to do, I think, with the overall positive experience which British citizens have had with the response of British authorities. It is not by chance, I hope that I'm not offending any Belgian citizen here in the room, that actually Belgium has actually one of the darkest colors of blue. I think the trust of Belgian citizens in the law enforcement capabilities of their own systems in the Dutroux affair has been severely shaken. So I think the Belgian citizens expect much more from the EU generally in this domain than the average. Common action. What has actually so far been achieved in terms of common action? First of all, I think we really have seen progress of putting into place elements of a common legal framework for the cross-border fight against terrorism. We have elements of legal harmonization in terms of the definition of terrorist acts, in terms of the definition of minimum penalties to be imposed. We also have a legal instrument to allow for the deployment of joint investigation teams, which can actually move across borders to investigate all the terrorist networks. So quite a bit of legislative activity to create at least a basis of a legal framework for action. Secondly, we have significant progress, I think, on institutionalized information sharing and coordination between national authorities in the field. Eurojust, which actually deals with cooperation between the prosecution authorities of the member states, It actually does not only, is not only engaged in facilitating interaction, but also in trying to steer, in certain cases, the prosecution activities in cross-border cases. Europol, which actually does the analysis work of the threats and also tries to coordinate in many cases interaction between national police authorities. Frontex, the external border management agency, which also has as part of its mandate to actually reinforce external border protection regarding all the terrorist activities, and the counter-terrorism coordinator in the council, who bears quite a ringing name, counter-terrorism coordinator, but to be frank, doesn't have so many real coordination powers. What the counter-terrorism coordinator actually mainly does is to monitor actually the implementation of EU objectives in the fight against terrorism, and he occasionally comes up with some pretty damning statements on the effectiveness of the action, both at the EU and the national level, but he cannot actually steer actively action by the member states. Therefore, the title is a bit more than the real function. Third element, a lot goes on in terms of best practice identification and transfer. So mutual evaluation procedures involving the member states, the development of common standards, the carrying out of training modules, training for police officers, training for prosecutors in this domain. And this is clearly something which is very often not so much visible, but very important. Because here you have a domain where experiences of member states who have really more in terms of a treasure of experience can also be passed on to member states which have less so. So for instance, on the British side, community policing has been identified as one of the elements which actually can help to dismantle terrorists, to identify terrorist groupings and to help dismantling them. And actually, community policing through the British example has actually been taken on as a subject, as a more serious subject also in other member states. Finally, you have international action also by the EU, bilateral cooperation with third countries. The most developed relationship is the one with the United States. But the EU is, for instance, also using external economic and financial instruments to try to shore up the international coalition against terrorism. For instance, the EU offered in 2002 Pakistan a better deal on economic cooperation in order to get Pakistan fully in line with the fight against the financing of terrorism. So the EU uses a variety of external relations instruments to foster the international counterterrorism agenda. What are the limits of common action? Well, on the whole, we still have only, still today, 27 national counterterrorism systems. What we have is a lot of action to facilitate the interaction between the national counterterrorism systems, but you don't have a real integration of the systems. You don't have any integrated counterterrorism capabilities of the European Union as such so far. And the legal harmonization is really minimalist harmonization. For instance, the least common denominator the member states could agree on in terms of penalties for terrorism is a minimum maximum penalty of 15 years in prison for directing a terrorist organization. Most of the member states have much higher thresholds, but it simply proved impossible to agree on a more substantial harmonization. So really minimalist harmonization and no transfer of operational powers to the European level. Also, you still have lots of major differences between the national approaches and structures. This leads to friction between the member state systems and a permanent need for a huge coordination effort of these 27 member states. When these working parties meet in the Council in Brussels, they spend most of their time not deliberating on substantive objectives, but trying to remove friction which exists between the member states to smooth out the cooperation process. So as long as you have 27 substantially different national systems, of course, the removal of friction, the working on interaction, absorbs most of the time and the energy. There are also major implementation deficits, simply because you have also different national systems which are implementing it. These systems are not effective in the same way in terms of implementing measures, and priorities may change. A minister may agree to a substantial EU action plan, but 1 year or 2 years afterwards, he may not have the same priority any longer. So when it comes to national implementing legislation, then this may be put off in order to avoid difficult debates. So really, major implementation deficits, what is adopted at the EU level, very often takes a long time to be effectively implemented. Example of the European arrest warrant, it should have been implemented by all of the member states 1st of January 2004, but in the end, the full implementation was only achieved in 2007, so 3 years more than actually planned. Also, a strong dimension of national bilateralism. So the member states cooperate bilaterally, but not through the EU level, and also member states who cooperate with third countries more intensively than with other member states. This makes it a bit more difficult for the EU to adopt a credible position also at the international stage if member states have, so to say, bilateral counterterrorism policies which are conducted with third countries. Reasons for the limits. Most often invoked is national sovereignty, territoriality, different law and order systems. This is obviously, let's say, not wrong, but I think the key reason is that national governments want to retain control of a particularly sensitive internal security issue. I recently spoke to a French police officer of the senior police officer of the about this matter and said, well, we could never allow the EU to fully take over this because if a major bomb goes up here in France, we will be blamed and our government will be blamed. So basically, we want to retain basically full control of this because we are ultimately held responsible for actually what happens in this domain. So you can see here really quite a pragmatic way of looking at it. And finally, I would say, and one has to say, that there is some real justification also behind this effort to keep this under national control, because you still have these different national threat situations. And you still have really different experiences of the national setting involved and also different capabilities of member states, because it's obvious that that the United Kingdom, for instance, has much more experience in fighting the terrorist challenge than, for instance, Poland. So you have different capabilities, actually, of coping with this challenge. It is also very questionable whether more centralized action by the EU would necessarily be more effective, because most of these terrorist organizations have actually a national or even a regional basis. And the police forces, the prosecutors in the member states are often much closer to the actual problems than there would be a centralized agency at the EU level. So this means that there is also some actually factual reason for actually justifying this national control of it. Common response, answer to the second question, yes, in the sense that we have common objectives, massive growth of cooperation structures and procedures, also elements of a common legal framework, and coordinated external action. But you can also say no, you can answer to the negative in the sense that there are still essentially 27 national counterterrorism systems which are not subject to an integrated legal system, central command and control functions, and related issues. Conclusions. Is the EU, therefore, an ineffective security actor? Because we don't have a harmonized system, if we don't have central counterterrorism capabilities? Well, I think one has to get the criteria right. What the EU's function is, according to also the treaty framework is to act as a subsidiary actor in this domain to provide added value and not to replace the member states in this essential security providing function. And this added value, I think, the EU provides through the increase of the intelligence base, which is available to national authorities by the sharing of intelligence, through the reduction of obstacles to cross-border cooperation in this field, and through the increased possibilities for collective action of the member states, both inside and outside of the EU. My final slide deals with the question, what way forward then for the EU in this domain? Now, at the Sussex European Institute, we have for several years carried out research into EU governance, into the various models of EU governance, various degrees of intensity. We have also participated in several EU-wide projects in this context. I think that in the counterterrorism domain, more hard governance of the European Union in terms of more centralization and harmonization is really problematic, not only because of the political obstacles, which I've mentioned at the beginning in terms of sovereignty and the willing of the member states to retain control of this domain, but also because there are potentially disruptive effects on national capabilities if we would go for a highly centralized system. If we would, for instance, establish a sort of FBI structure with full, so to say, federal powers in the European Union, we would probably have several years where actually this creation of a central command structure with central powers would actually interfere with well-established national capabilities until the system would actually start to work effectively. And during this period of years, at least, I think we would have probably a net loss in terms of overall counterterrorism capabilities. One therefore has to look with great care in which domains more hard governance, especially through legislation and centralization, is justified. But on a number of issues, it really should be envisaged. I'm thinking in particular about fundamental and judicial rights protection, because increasingly we have in the cooperation between the member states issues which can have an impact on the individual, be it only data exchange procedures, but also if you consider the European arrest warrant, for instance, there are questions about adequate judicial rights protection because guarantees the procedures in the member states vary considerably. Where I see greater potential is in more EU soft governance in this domain, and this means actually strengthening coordination and information mechanisms, not necessarily with legislative means, best practices transfer, trust building between national authorities. And I think a very good example here is actually the work of Eurojust, which actually without having hard powers to actually direct national prosecution services, provides a lot of added value by bringing prosecutors together, by trying to make prosecutors realize the European dimension, and by actually giving guidance to national prosecutors, which is not in the full legal sense binding, but really over time, I think, it changes the overall cooperation framework. There's also an argument here that soft governance instruments can be better adapted and tailor-made to meet the operational needs of those who actually are at the forefront in the fight against terrorism. This means the specialized police officers, this means the prosecutors in the field, because ultimately those practitioners have actually to conduct this fight against terrorism. And whatever the EU provides in added value, will obviously that the final intention benefits the citizens, but it has to be effectively usable by those who have actually to win this combat with terrorism. And soft governance can be much more quickly adapted to changing operational needs. It also allows enough flexibility for actually practitioners choosing the bits which are most useful for supporting the work Therefore, I think this is another strong reason for developing the soft governance domain by preference more than the hard governance. My final remark would be that what I already said, in a sense, that all this EU action is ultimately for the benefit of the citizen, to enhance the citizen's security, but it needs to be adapted to, needs to be tailor-made, needs always to be put into place with actually those who have to implement this as a practical level in mind. So let's always think about EU action from the perspective also of the user friendliness of what actually comes out of this European process, and I think overall this will benefit all of us. Well, I would close on this remark.